From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's hard to name another genus of shrub that's more beloved by gardeners than hydrangea. But with the overwhelming popularity of Asian species like the big blue mopheads and summer into fall hydrangea paniculata types, where do hydrangeas fit in as more and more gardeners favor native plants, and especially ones that support pollinators and other beneficial insects? The native plant experts at Mount Cuba Center in Delaware have just released a report on the results of a five-year trial that focused mostly on an important native species, hydrangea arborescens, and what both gardeners and pollinators have to say about its range of cultivars. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including Away to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
The last time Sam Hoadley visited the show, we compared the dizzying range of cultivars and species of Echinacea. Today's topic is hydrangeas. Sam is the manager of horticultural research at Mount Cuba Center, a longtime native plant garden and research site where he trialed 29 species and cultivars. Before joining Mount Cuba, he was lead horticulturist for Longwood Gardens Hillside Garden, and he received his degree in sustainable horticulture from University of Vermont. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
How's the winter been down there in the mid-Atlantic?
Yeah, it's been good. We were enjoying some unseasonably warm temperatures for a while, and we just had the reality check in the last 2 weeks that it is actually winter. So we had temperatures, but it looks like it's warming up a little bit too, you know, just kind of the usual thaw and freeze.
Yeah. So you've been busy as always with the research and then the reports, which I always enjoy so much over the years that Mount Cuba has created from its trial garden program, and the latest being hydrangea. And maybe first, before we get to the results and so forth, maybe first we need to sort of give the quick overview of this genus, because, you know, the ones you trialed may not be the ones that are taking up the most real estate in American gardens. Do you know what I mean? So maybe
Absolutely.
We kind of say, okay, you guys may be growing this, but we looked into these because. Can we have that sort of backstory?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, there's this kind of a dizzying array of hydrangeas that are available to gardeners today. A lot of times when people think hydrangea, they think of the big macrophylla types that are, you know, pink to blue. And a lot of people know that, you know, soil acidity can affect that color. I think many people know of hydrangea, even if you're not necessarily interested in horticulture. I think those are the images that come to mind. But we are really interested in this kind of smaller range of native species. And the Eastern United States has four native species included. And this hydrangea trial incorporated three that are very closely related. A little bit different. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying, so you chose ones that are closely related. I see. Because I knew there was one you didn't include that's a Native American. Uh-huh.
Yes, but that is coming up. Spoiler, we are planning an oak leaf hydrangea trial that will be going into the trial garden this spring. So stay tuned for that. That will be the fourth and final hydrangea species that we'll be trialing in the gardens here.
Oh, so you started with these ones that are closely related to hydrangea arborescens or arborescens itself.
And, exactly.
And that's sort of Eastern, but not New England. And, you know, when I look at the range maps, I mean, you look at range maps for a species and it doesn't mean it's in literally every spot in every state, but if it's in a state, they show it as present.
Right.
You know, I didn't look at county by county, but it's sort of like the eastern third of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hydrangea arborescens is actually fairly widespread throughout the eastern United States. It becomes a little more rare on the fringes of its range. It does extend up into New York State and down into northern Florida, but it's fairly, I don't want to say common, but it's can be observed throughout the Appalachian Mountains and a little bit into the central United States. I've actually seen this growing in woodlands in eastern Pennsylvania fairly locally to us.
Right.
And then there are two They used to be subspecies, so very closely related to hydrangea arborescens, that have now been elevated to their own species status, which those two species are hydrangea radiata or silverleaf hydrangea. And really the big ID feature of that one is that's the silvery, almost metallic white backs to the leaves. Smaller native range, it's really native to mountains in the southeastern United States. And then there's hydrangea cinerea, which again is very similar to hydrangea arborescens and hydrangea radiata, but the backs of the leaves have kind of this grayish silvery pubescence. They're kind of fuzzy, and that's more of a Midwestern and Southeastern United States plant. Arborescens is the straight species hydrangea arborescens is definitely the most widespread.
I remember the first time I saw radiata, it was at a nursery in Connecticut at Broken Arrow Nursery, and
yes,
one of the horticulturists there turned the leaf over. He said, oh, let me show you something. He turned the leaf over and I was like, what? I mean, it was just, you know, it was like green on top, but oh my goodness, silvery white below. And when you see it in the garden, particularly if it was used in the right spot where, you know, it's a little bit elevated, maybe on a slope or something like that.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness. It's just like a whole other thing going on besides when it's in flower, right? It's just,
exactly.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. And we use them extensively in our naturalistic gardens here. And when there's a kind of a slight breeze going through the woodlands, that you get kind of the shimmering effect and adds landscape. I think it's my favorite species that we trialed. It didn't do well in the trials, and we can go into why that happened. But in the gardens here, it's just absolutely spectacular. And it is available. Broken Arrow is a good source. I know Quackengrass Nursery in northeastern Connecticut has them available. They're out there. They're just not as widely available as regular hydrangea arborescens in your pulp.
Yeah. So arborescens. So, you know, if one of the most popular questions, being a garden writer for 200 years already now, probably that I'm asked year in and year out, day in and day out, is when do I prune my hydrangeas?
Sure.
And, you know, the answer is different for, you know, the big mop heads versus the paniculatas, and has to do with whether they bloom on new wood produced that season or old wood, and so on and so forth. And so what about these? Are these, how are the arborescence and its kin? Where do they fit in?
Yeah, so they are, one of the things that's great about hydrangea arborescens and cinerea and radiata, you can treat them very similarly. They do the same things as far as where you would want to site them in the landscape, in most cases, and pruning. They all share in common that they bloom on new wood, which essentially means that those flower buds that are going to be produced in June and July that will produce those flower buds aren't produced until that growing season. So that means you can prune these plants really heavily from fall even to early spring, and you're not going to impact the floral display for that year. Something like hydrangea macrophylla that blooms on old wood, those flower buds are present all winter long on the terminal buds of those stems. And there's always the chance that a late frost or fluctuating temperatures will cause those buds to break early, and then a frost will kill them. And with some of the older cultivars of hydrangea macrophylla in particular, that will dramatically impact your floral display for the year. But hydrangea arborescens is super reliable. You can really abuse these plants and they will come back and bloom for you.
And so traditionally, there was one cultivar, the ubiquitous Annabelle,
yes.
of hydrangea arborescens. And I think it was from like the 1960s or something.
Yep.
And it just became such a giant hit. And even here, I'm in rural New York State, and in the front of old houses, you know, that might have done a landscape update again, like in the 60s or 70s or whatever, you know, you'll see these giant, almost like hedges of this thing, you know, or like foundation planting, like rows of them, you know, and those giant white mop top flowers of Annabelle. Yep. And she's a floppy girl.
Yes, she is.
She's a floppy girl. Yeah.
Yes.
In flower. But so it's a beloved plant, or it has been, but then we found out, as we've become more aware in recent years, of the, even among a native species, when you get to a native plant, when you get to a cultivar level, they're not all equal. They're not all created equal in terms of their ecological, you know, services that they provide to to a habitat. So what's the deal? Like, why is it that, you know, we don't just go out and keep on planting Annabelle? What's the deal?
Yeah, so Annabelle is kind of an interesting story, even where that plant came from. It was a natural mutation that was found, I believe, in Illinois originally at the beginning, early 1900s, and wasn't actually introduced into cultivation until the 1960s. But there was a cultivar even earlier than Annabelle called Grandiflora, and was originally called Hills of Snow. But this was also a plant that was found in the wild that exhibited these huge mop head type inflorescences. So these things existed in nature, but there's definitely drawbacks, as you mentioned, with their ability to attract and very likely support pollinators. With mop heads in particular, there are very few or a fewer fertile flowers inside of those inflorescences. The majority of what you're actually seeing are sterile flowers, which makes for a very showy inflorescence, gives you that classic look that we're used to seeing in heirloom gardens, cottage gardens around the United States. But there's very little there for pollinators, or in theory, very little there for pollinators. More wild type plants that are more typical of species that you would see in wild populations exhibit a lace cap flower inflorescence. So essentially that lace cap inflorescence is much more flat, and the center is comprised primarily of fertile flowers. And these are offering benefits like pollen and nectar to pollinators. And on the perimeter, the outer ring of that inflorescence, you're seeing some sterile flowers, but relatively few, and in some populations, none at all.
Right.
But that's where we expected to see the most pollinator visitation. And when we actually went through our pollinator observations here in the trial garden, it was very clear cut that pollinators were going to lace cap hydrangeas. Not exclusively, but in much, much higher numbers than the mop head selections and cultivars.
Right. And so if people don't know the sterile versus the fertile flower and so forth, the florets or whatever we want to call them, you know, it's almost like the flat, if you think of a hydrangea, and it's this, even the big puffy mop heads, it's this big ball of these little flat florets, or I think some people call them bracts. I'm not even sure technically what's what, but you know, they're, and those aren't providing the nectar and pollen, as you said, but sometimes tucked in between, and especially in the lace cap types where those flat ones might be around the edge, the perimeter, like you were explaining, there's these little dots that don't look like much to a human, right? To a gardener, you know, in the middle, and lots of them. But those are flowers, and those are full of yummy stuff if you're an insect. So the insects, maybe they are guided to it by the showiness of the outer ones, right? But they're, hey, let's go over there. I see some. But what they're going to dine on is the stuff in the middle or in between, right? The little tiny insignificant looking flowers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for such a large shrub, those flowers are extremely minute and they produce even smaller seed. It's kind of amazing to us to see these teeny, teeny, tiny seeds that eventually will produce, you know, an 8 foot tall by 9 foot wide shrub in the largest cases in, you know, 5 to 7 years.
Yeah. So we have this sort of, you did these trials of, I think it was 29 species and cultivars, closely related, many of them arborescents. The winners, it's almost like in this report, there's the gardener viewpoint of the winners, and then there's a page that has this chart about the pollinator visits to each trialed cultivar or species. And that's quite different. The ones that are on the top in terms of garden performance are not necessarily the ones that are on the top in terms of insect appeal, right? I mean, that it's...
Yes.
Yeah. that was kind of, that's kind of interesting. So let's, I don't know, where do we want to start? Should we talk about the ones, we've just a little bit talked about the ones that have the most insect appeal without naming names.
Sure.
I want to talk about, I mean, Annabelle and arborescence, straight arborescence are white flowers, but not all of them are even white anymore. And I'm seeing more and more of these from Proven Winners and from North Carolina State University breeding. I'm seeing more and more of these, you know, mop toppy looking ones. Some of them are in different colors, but it surprises me to see more mop heady kind of ones coming out when everybody's interest seems to be in pollinator plants. So that conflict, you know, that that tension between those two goals. So tell me about it from your point of view, because you were looking at both.
Yeah, we were definitely looking at both. So we're always interested, and we're always going to, essentially our goal is to promote plants that work well in the Mid-Atlantic region. And we're looking at plants from two perspectives. We're looking at them from a horticultural perspective, and this would be coming back to our mission. We're looking at we want to inspire people about the beauty and value of native plants. So
right.
It would be the horticultural value, and then value would be, you know, ecological value for insect pollinators specifically. We are looking at both sides of the coin there. So there's always going to be plants that might just be beautiful if they perform well, but we're also trying to promote plants that are great for pollinators. And in some cases, there's great compromises. So like something like Hydrangea arborescens Haas Halo, absolutely striking, beautiful plant, incredible floral display. It is a lace cap hydrangea, so lace cap flower type, and it's attracting tons of pollinators in addition to being a beautiful kind of classic landscape plant. And then there are plants that are, you know, the mop head types, which are beautiful plants, but they may not be attracting as many. So essentially what we're just trying to do is provide you a well-rounded view of this genus so that people can make informed decisions based on their various garden goals. If you want that classic look of that big mop head hydrangea, we've got a hydrangea for you. If you're more like me and you really are gardening for wildlife, this chart is really where I would be paying attention to.
All right.
So something like Hydrangea arborescens White Dome, even just straight species Hydrangea arborescens, these are plants that were attracting insects in droves. And that's really something that we do pay attention to. We've actually been, in recent years, been linking our pollinator scores with the horticultural scores. So plants that attract more pollinators are getting a slight bump at the end of the trial in their scores. So something like Hydrangea arborescens Total Eclipse, that bump might have been just enough for it to reach our top performers list. So we do want to be recommending a well-rounded group of plants, both from horticultural perspectives and from ecological perspectives. But there's often plants that have great great features of both.
Right. And you know, one of the first native plant cultivars that I planted here 100 billion years ago, not that I'm feeling old today, Sam, or anything, all these references to previous centuries, was because it came from a visit to Mount Cuba a very long time ago, when Dick Leidy was there, and he had developed a cultivar of a twig dogwood called Silver and Gold, Cornus cerisea Silver and Gold, yep, with gold stems and so forth. And so it's a cultivar, so it's a little different. It doesn't have green leaves. It has white and green variegated leaves, which, as we now know, means it's maybe a little less useful to certain insects for certain things, but it still has a lot of the other traits. And I put it right in my front yard. It's one of the first things you see when you come in. And, mm-hmm. But then I have the straight species, a lot of them sort of up on the hill in the back, a whole big group of them. And I keep thinking about that as a way to say how to balance, even if we both want what the gardener likes, showiness, and what the insects like, which might be a little less showy in some ways, although that Haas Halo you said is so gorgeous for both insects and people.
Right.
So I kind of think a little bit of like, maybe you can have a few of these show-offs in a prominent spot, but maybe you can also make room for some of the ones that are a little less so in a little less showy of a spot. Do you know what I mean? Kind of a balance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really about that perfect plant for the perfect place. And we've tried to promote plants that, you know, a spectrum of people could utilize in their home landscapes. Even if you just have a small patio garden, we try to have recommendations for you so that even just by adding one native plant to your home landscape, you're doing some good. Even if it is a cultivar, many of these cultivars are still supporting some insects. It might not be as many as
yes,
if you were to plant some of these mop heads. There's some value, not much, but it's still very likely more than non-native plants that aren't from Eastern North America. We like to call that conservation by addition. Even by adding one plant to your home landscape, and no matter how you're doing it, you are moving the needle in a good direction.
Okay. I like that. I like that. Conservation by, you said by addition. Is that what you said?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I like that. That's great. That's a great idea. Okay. So tell us about some, we have, you know, 5-6 minutes. Tell us about some of the winners, quote unquote. I mean, because again, they're not all white either. Not only are they not all lace caps, but they're not all white. So tell us about some of the standouts that and why.
Yeah, absolutely. So to me, if you can only have one hydrangea in your home landscape, and I mean, you just have one, room for one plant and it can be a slightly larger plant, Hydrangea arborescens Haas Halo is my number one choice. I saw it in the trial garden, was kind of blown away by the floral display, even when the plants were in bud. But as soon as they started blooming, there was a frenzy of insect activity on these flowers. And I went out that day and bought one for my home garden. it's an incredible, beautiful combination of horticultural value and ecological value. And it is the top performing plant in our trial from every perspective. We grew these in full sun. We grew them in some shade. We even cut an example of these back for 3 springs in a row in late March just to see what they would do. And it did really remarkably well under that treatment as well. There's a few plants out there that from proven winners, and including hydrangea lime ricky, which is a really cool plant. It's a very large hydrangea, but it has this beautiful kind of color changing inflorescence. It is a mop head. With less pollinator value, it's not one that I would choose if you are trying to garden for wildlife, but it is very interesting from a horticultural perspective. The flowers start off kind of this lime green, then they fade to more kind of an ivory tone, and the fertile flowers actually have some pink in them and offer contrast. And then as those flowers fade, they kind of fade back to that lime green again. And as you mentioned, there's some beautiful pink cultivars that are coming out there. And that's really kind of a recent trend in the horticultural world and horticultural breeding with hydrangea arborescens. And a lot of that's coming out of North Carolina State University and Dr. Tom Rainey there, really kind of on the cutting edge of breeding in this new color in hydrangea arborescens. And essentially how that's accomplished is by starting with some of these white mop heads and breeding in with some of these lace cap pink flowering selections of hydrangea arborescens, such as, there's a couple out there. We had Eco Pink Puff, and which is one of those kind of starter plants.
Right.
And what you end up with are eventually, through a lot of selection, is these large pink mop heads. And there were two in our trials that I thought did really remarkably well. Hydrangea arborescens Incredible Blush is one of the best. It's a smaller plant, about 4 feet tall and wide at its largest after 5 years. Huge flower heads, sturdy stems. Again, not as great for pollinators, but it gives you that classic hydrangea look in a very reliable plant. And interestingly, most plants in the full sun in our trials didn't do as well when you were compared to the plants in the shade.
Oh.
This just lasted a little bit longer in the shade and they tended to not burn as much. But with hydrangea arborescens, Incredible Blush, and a similar plant, well, larger but pink plant as well that came out of the same breeding program, Invincible Spirit 2, these plants did better in full sun. And that is a trend that we notice. These pink flowering plants, pink flowering versions of normally white flowering plants, do better with a little bit of extra sun. Those two pink flowered ones that we loved. And then there's a couple out there that are just really great alternatives to Annabelle and Grandiflora. And those include Incredible and Bounty, both big mop heads, but they're improved versions, very sturdy stems, resistant to flopping. Again, give you that very mop head look. And then we had a couple interesting ones that aren't as widely available, but if you can find them, absolutely go get them. One of those was Hydrangea arborescens Mary Nell. It's another great mix of horticultural and ecological value. Very similar to Haas Halo. It has more sterile flowers around the perimeter, so arguably it's a more showy plant, and it still has good pollinator value. And this was actually introduced by the same person who introduced Annabelle back in the 60s.
Oh!
It's just not out there as much. I know Hydrangea Plus Nursery, it's an online nursery, carries it.
Yes.
While we're checking there. And we're trying to get this one out in the trade as well. But it's a really great plant, particularly when it's in some shade. It's fabulous. And then finally, Hydrangea arborescens Total Eclipse was a wonderful plant as well. A great, beautiful plant for naturalistic gardens, and very similar to the straight species Hydrangea arborescens from both a horticultural perspective and an ecological perspective. I think the two of them attracted, I think there was a difference of 3 pollinator visits over 2 years.
Okay.
Very, very similar performance. If you can't find Total Eclipse, Hydrangea arborescens is another just fantastic garden option.
Okay.
Again, well, not quite as showy as some of the mop heads, but tons of pollinator activity on these plants.
Well, Sam Hudley at Mount Cuba Center, thank you so much. And what are you trialing next?
Yeah, so we are currently in the trial garden. We have a Carex trial, which is wrapping up this fall. So look forward to that. We'll be releasing our Carex research report next January. We are also trialing goldenrods, ironweeds, and brand new oak leaf hydrangea trial.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, and I hope I'll speak to you again soon. Thanks for making time today, Sam.
Thanks so much for having me.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.